Good morning. It's a lovely day. I trust you all have, from your own practice, experience, confirmed, made clear for yourself the process, so to speak, of gathering all into one. In the beginning, it can be a difficult, tedious, over and over again, wandering off in thought, having to come back again, wandering off in thought again, maybe again, returning. Maybe falling asleep because of all the effort involved. It can be a very difficult at times, very frustrating. And yet, all we are doing is allowing mind to return to its original oneness. So it's really not anything difficult at all. The difficulty is what our mind does with it, how our mind tries to manipulate and control and so on. Once again, in sustained zazen, what we are doing is really just allowing mind to return to its original oneness, to the real unity that it is. Do you see? It's not at all anything difficult or far away. In a sense, it is returning to that which is inseparable. Somehow, in experience, we separate that from which we come. We cannot really fully separate ourselves from. We're always connected. But we can say we are connected, but separate. And that is the dis-ease of our experience. That is, I suppose, why we are all here. We sense the need to be one, and yet we recognize that we are not. Thus, there are religious practices such as zazen. So please keep in mind, as you honestly struggle, that what we are aiming at is not some kind of distant, metaphysical, esoteric, veiled, hidden reality. On the contrary, we're simply allowing mind to return to the organic, natural unity that it really is. We're not trying to manipulate mind or consciousness in some way to reach some kind of transcendent state. Not at all. Not at all. Of course, in the actual process, we may find ourselves falling into some state or another. It's good to recognize what is going on, but never to get stuck there. So once again, as you actually gather all into one, at some point, it becomes clear all is gathered into one. It seems like a process. But when it finally becomes clear, in a sense, what becomes clear is that all is, always has been, one. It is we that were, in a sense, separate from it. And so in returning to that, so to speak, returning to the original oneness that we are, inseparable, not separate. From this side, yes, it's something that we scratch and we scrape and we struggle and we fall away a little bit, then we come closer, then the sleepiness disturbs us and the pain takes us away, and oh, maybe it even brings us closer. But when we finally fall in a sense, all of that becomes irrelevant. As helpful as it was on the way, when we finally fall in, it's not really a smooth, logical transition. Once again, the process, the discipline, the training, the mindfulness, returning again and again, all of this is most helpful. It's most helpful on the way. But very simply, when we fall in, one way to describe what becomes obvious is that we realize what we have always been. We realize that we have been this. We don't even really come to it for the first time. That's why expressions like awakening as if from a dream, or a word like realizing it, or actualizing it, returning to the source. A dangerous metaphor, but it speaks quite accurately on one level. So once again, take all of the energy that you have and pour yourself into the moment-to-moment practice. Yes, it is a discipline. Yes, it requires patience and determination. Don't worry about what, when, why, how. Just give yourself completely. At some point, things will turn. The attempt to get inside, for example, will all of a sudden be the realization that, oh, I've been inside all along. I couldn't have gotten out. How could I have ever been out of this? I couldn't have. This is an important turn in the practice. But of course, if we get all wrapped up in that, stuck there, then it's of no use at all. So it's important to know how to practice as a process, as a struggle, patiently working on it, returning again and again. We also need to know when that turn occurs, how to practice there as well. In a sense, it's at least as important to know how to practice there. Of course, the practice is quite different. It's quite different. But it's still very important, or otherwise we get stuck into our freedom. We become attached to our so-called freedom, and of course it is utterly lost in the process. Once again, working through patiently, returning again and again, gathering all into one. At one point, it may become self-evident. All is gathered into one. Then what? Then what? How do you proceed from there? Of course, this is one reason why we have over and over one-on-one, so that when you're at a point like that, you don't get stuck or turn it into something that it isn't, so that you can continue on smoothly. How to put it? if our practice is not true, not genuine, not sincere, not pure, well, we're doing it with some intention in mind. We want to improve ourselves. We want to have some enlightenment experience that will solve all our problems, and then we'll become the biggest no-self around, or whatever. These are precisely the things that become frustrations in our practice, because maybe we do achieve it, but of course it's never quite what we expect it to be, what we want it to be. And so there's a gap, there's a separation. As we give ourselves patiently, naturally in our practice, those intentions, those bluntly we might say selfish motives, just start to fall away, just start to fall away. And we find ourselves simply sitting, the practice itself. We don't need a reason. We don't need to see on the meter some improvement at every step. It doesn't work that way anyway. We just give all of ourselves to the practice. So much that we don't even have a thought for, maybe I'm at 95 on the scale of 100. Huh? I'm getting close. That itself is, of course, coming out of it and separating from it. Or saying, I'll never get there. I'll just never get there. This is also simply separating from what is present right here and right now. So the difficulty is the sheer simplicity. Just giving all of yourself, every last drop, so much so that there's no question. When? Where? How? Why not yet? You see? All of those are unnecessary questions that simply, in a sense, take us away from the task at hand, the immediate task. So, if we are sincerely, if I use that word, purely seeking, of course, we're not seeking for something. We're not seeking for a state of mind. So to say seek, that which we sincerely seek, in other words, that which we really are, comes to show us the way. I don't mean spirits coming at all. What I mean is the ground of our experience becomes clear, as if almost like gravity. And so we naturally gravitate, are pulled in that right direction. At that point, nothing can get in the way. No thoughts or ideas or even experiences. That which we sincerely seek on our religious quest, that which we really are, shows us the way, is that very path. When this becomes clear, that immediacy in the practice, in a sense, nothing can get in the way then. Again, a very important step on the path. But we need to know how to walk it there as well. So again, struggling, working patiently. But we know if we're going in the right direction, because it is as if that which we are seeking, yes, we're not completely one with it, we're still separate, that's okay, but we're working in the right direction. We're not going outside, but we're not, in the ordinary sense, going inside our mind, thoughts, ideas, memories, reflections. That's no better than outside. But rather, directly into the source itself. That which we sincerely seek, that which we really are, draws us in. In other words, it's simply that which we are not cannot be separate from. It's kind of like, you know, if you have suspenders on and it gets caught on the table and you start running, well, you can't really get away from it. You're stuck on the table, and yet you're still trying to run away from it. Eventually what you realize is no matter how hard you ran or how much you stretched the suspenders, you were still a part of that table. You couldn't get free, no matter how hard. Then you can stop that fruitless effort. And you can embrace your friend, the table. So again, that which you truly see, it's that which you really are, opens itself up and shows you the way you must go. No, it doesn't become an object of consciousness. Of course not. How could it? But that doesn't mean that it's some kind of dreamy, spacey, otherworldly thing. No, it's the most immediate. Compared with this, the glass of water is abstract. Do you see? That which we are inseparable, not separated, huh? Inseparable from. That is what finally shows us the way. Anything else can get in the way. Any other way, path, even zazen, can get in the way. Do you understand? The ego self can corrupt, can distort anything it comes into contact with, whether it be meditation or mantras or sutras or anything. That is why all of you know something of Zen. Zen has such an ambiguous position towards ways and methods, even zazen. Even zazen, the sixth patriarch of Chinese Zen. If you read the entire Platform Sutra, it's called, attributed to his talks, never once does it mention he even sat in zazen, and yet he was the sixth patriarch of Chan, which means, in a sense, the meditation sect of Buddhism. But not once does it even mention he sat in meditation. He was actually an illiterate woodcutter, so when he was in the monastery, he was put to work pounding the rice. But he wasn't worthy of being a monk in the monastery and practicing. So he was working in the kitchen, pounding the rice. Well, we don't know the actual history. Did that really happen? I don't know. If it didn't, it should have. But there was a point in the Zen tradition, to some extent, creating that story, because they're making it clear. It's realizing that which we are not separate from. If that's what happens in zazen, fine. But if you simply sit there twiddling your thumbs and concocting preposterous ideas and notions and imaginations and fantasies, well, that's not zazen, is it? So, once again, and I'm not making this up, even being here in this wonderful Catholic nunnery, let me paraphrase Meister Eckhart. Meister Eckhart says the same thing. He says, those who search for ways to God find ways, but not God, who in ways is hidden. Of course. You can't take a way to God. You can't take a path to God. How do you realize the grace of Christianity? The only way to really know the grace of God is for you to give up every possible way that you have, isn't it? As long as you're trying to get to God, He's not there. When you finally give up your wanting to get there, it becomes apparent that He was the ground of your existence. He was the very question you were asking. Again, this is just to put it in Christian context. And of course in Zen, over and over. Even to set upon the quest for awakening is to go contrary-wise. It's one of the early nonsense expressions. To take the first step on the path is already wrong. Do you see? For the self to attempt to get somewhere other than where it is already to be in delusion. In a sense, perhaps we can't help but do that, but it helps to see what is going on. So once again, any way, any means, any method can be very helpful, including Zazen. That's what we're doing here. But at the same time, if the self gets wrapped up in it and is using it for its own purposes, if it becomes a means to some end, it is corrupt. It is not pure. There's no magic in sitting in this posture. So please use these methods, these ways, including seated meditation, Zazen. But do not corrupt them. Do not stain them. Do not make them other than what they are. Let them be what they truly are. Please feel free to stand up and stretch for a moment if you'd like. So I trust you can see from your own experience this struggle that we go through, and all of us, everyone goes through it. This struggle to try sincerely, patiently, to make our practice right, correct. It takes some time. How long will it take? We can't say. For some people it takes years. For some people it just happens. Doesn't matter. We give ourselves to the practice without concern for that. And if we do that, that infinite distance, that tremendous difficulty, the impossibility of really practicing eventually becomes completely natural, inevitable. That infinite distance becomes no distance at all. It takes some time. That's okay. That's what we're here for now. 2 days to really just make this clear, unmistakable, so that when we go back out into the world, so to speak, there's no question of separating from it again. Perhaps that's the most important thing in this kind of a retreat, is to give ourselves so that it's unmistakable, conclusive, decisive, not, I think I kind of, yeah, when I fell asleep and I was dreaming there, I think I got an idea there about something. That's worthless. That's less than worthless. We struggle finally to realize that we are inseparable. We are not separate from. But yes, we must struggle to know that for ourselves. Not the idea, the concept, the notion. Again, that is useless by itself. It is less than useless. There's a wonderful story at the end of the Genjo Koan. It's the first chapter of Dogen's Shobo Genzo. It was actually written, that chapter. It's called Genjo Koan, the Koan Manifest Here and Now. It was written for a layperson. And at the end of that chapter, not very long, 5-6 pages, Dogen recites a famous Chinese Zen story. And I think it may speak to you now after about 24 hours practicing here together. A monk comes to a master, and the monk says, the master, it was summer, the master happened to be fanning himself with a hand fan. Huh? So the master was fanning himself, it was hot. And the monk came, and as we'll see with the rice crackers a little bit later, there are metaphors being used here. It helps to understand. As most of you know, the rice crackers, in context, after the wind stops blowing, a few petals fall. A bird sings, the mountain stillness deepens. I'll explain later, but that last part is what's written on the rice crackers, which is a gift from the head abbot of Tofu. It also happens to be his name as a Zen master, even deeper still. So there are many levels of meaning. But another, people call it symbolism. It's not quite symbolism, but anyway, the wind, after the wind stops blowing, a few petals fall. What is being expressed there is, in our efforts, in our struggle, wind is a metaphor for practice in China. It's a very common metaphor for cultivation, practice, or the results thereof. So here it's saying in this poem, the rice crackers we'll have later, after the wind stops blowing, a few petals fall. In other words, yes, we give ourselves completely to our practice, but that doesn't produce awakening. That doesn't enlighten us. It's a necessary step, but that doesn't create enlightenment. So just like, and the Chinese are masters of using metaphors from nature. So yes, the wind has to blow, but after the wind stops blowing, if you look carefully, it actually happens that way often. The wind blows, and then it stops. And then in that pregnant moment, the petals fall, or the leaves from the tree will fall. Not, of course, when the wind blows, sometimes the leaves fall, but often, after the wind stops blowing, then it falls. Returning now to Dogen's Genjo Koan, the same kind of metaphor is being used. So the master happened to be fanning himself. The monk knew the language. He knew the Zenistic language. So he said, Master, the nature of the wind is constant. right? All beings have the Buddha nature, right? We are inseparable from it. Jeff said it himself. So the monk is throwing up, regurgitating these notions. Master, the nature of the wind is constant. Why do you bother fanning yourself? A good Zenistic question, isn't it? Huh? The nature of the wind is constant. Why do you need to fan yourself? He's not just asking about the fan and the wind. He's talking about the depth of the master's realization, of course. He's challenging the master. The master responds, "You only know the nature of the wind is constant. You don't know the meaning of its reaching everywhere." Again, he simply takes the monk's half-baked ideas, understanding of Buddhist philosophy, right, and throws it back in his face. Okay, so once again, the monk says, the master is fanning himself, the monk comes. Master, the nature of the wind is constant. All beings, we're all already saved. Numberless beings set free, right? We just said it this morning. The nature of the wind is constant. Why is there the need to fan yourself? So again, in a sense, the master is already starting to correct his understanding by saying, you only know, to clarify, in your head maybe, intellect, you only know that the nature of the wind is everywhere. That's right. It's not lacking. It's everywhere, absolutely. But you don't know the meaning of its reaching everywhere. The actual dynamic of it reaching everywhere. So the monk says, well, what is the meaning of its reaching everywhere? The master simply continued fanning himself. The monk realized and made a deep bow to the master. But do you see the difference between what the monk was doing? What the master was doing. The master was just fanning himself. He was hot. But the monk was cogitating very nice Buddhist philosophy, right? The nature of the wind is constant. Why do you need to fan yourself? This is the nature of the wind. But we have to bring it to life. I hope this will help you at least a little bit if you bother to read some of those Zen stories, to have an eye, to take care not to read them too lightly, but to try to see the living dynamic at work. Please do take care. Most of us have been up most of the night. Maybe we got a nap, but we were basically sitting through the night. Be careful going up and down the stairs. If you go out for a walk, it can be a little slippery, so please take extra care. Okay? And when you come to do one-on-one, It's a little less formal than traditional Japanese style, so you don't need to do a lot of bows. You can simply walk into the room and sit down, then we bow to each other. It's mutual. We bow to each other. That's all. Then when it's over, once again, we bow to each other, and you simply can get up and leave if you want. If you want to bow more, you can, but it's not necessary. When we begin, we bow to each other, and when it's over, we once again bow to each other. That's enough. It also saves time. Huh? Also, we will again tonight sit through the night. So each one of you has to judge for yourself Are you taking a train home? Are you driving home? Do you have a long way to go? Especially if you're driving home, know your physical limits. Yes, you may be feeling just, yeah, I know what he's saying. It's great stuff. But still, we have a body. It has limits. So if you feel the need so that you're sure you can get home safely tomorrow, do get some sleep if you need, okay? Don't trust the session, the retreat high to get you home safely, okay? If you need to rest or have some coffee, please take great care. And if necessary, you may want to get some sleep tonight, especially if you're driving home. Does anyone have a question from out of this practice that could be shared and of use to everyone? Perhaps of benefit for others? Anyone want to raise a question here and now? Clear what needs to be done. Not so much more, but perhaps less. But less in a very subtle way. We're giving ourselves completely, and thus, in a sense, we're doing less. It can be a difficult struggle, I know. It can be very frustrating at times. That's okay. That's one of the great benefits of practicing together. We can support each other and move on through in those moments when we just can't seem to make it by ourselves. Again, no need to create notions or ideas or Buddhist philosophies. Simply let that which you are truly seeking, that which you truly are, lead you in the practice. Not ideas, not notions, not things you learned. That inseparable. No questions, no concerns? Yeah.
You have told about two meanings of zazen. Maybe in the beginning, somebody starts to sit zazen, there's a danger that zazen becomes kind of a fetish. I want to do that.
Fetish, yeah.
I'm one of the hardest,
yeah.
And I'm an extreme sitter.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, one can reach the point where zazen loses this character.
Mm.
And one can see that zazen is necessary, but zazen is not the core of what to do.
Mm.
How to support people to see this point.
Mm.
Or better to cross this point.
Mm. Well, one good way is you're telling us it right now. Huh? Could you all follow that? Could you all understand that? When you realize that, do you stop doing zazen?
No.
Of course not, right? In a sense, when you realize that, the zazen for the first time really becomes pure. But you're not driven in the same way. The zazen drives itself then. In a sense, in a sense, zazen, we realize zazen is not the main point. The form that we take, this mental and physical embodiment, as important as it is not the point of Zen. Of course, that's one of the reasons the sixth patriarch was depicted as never doing it. But when we really see that point clearly, that's when the sitting becomes even more important, in a sense. We're not trapped by it. It becomes something living then. We don't cease, one of the points I want to make clear. We don't then stop doing it, right? I don't have to do zazen anymore. No, then the farther you go, the deeper it gets. But that zazen is different. I think that's one of the things you're saying, huh? The character of that zazen is different. So please give yourself to zazen. It's a superb, marvelous way. But don't get trapped by it. Especially when you get good at it, huh? When you get proficient, when it starts to work. As I mentioned yesterday, the, what did I call them? Zazen machines, right? These people just, without any human feeling, whatever, they just become Zazen machines, perfecting some kind of, they have some notion of themselves that they're perfecting. This is a great danger. This is a valuable point. Do you want to say anything else, Hartman?
It's a very concrete problem in our group. Because there are some people, they regard zazen as discipline, as a sitting machine. And we have the problem to translate that there's another way to see zazen.
Yeah.
And my question was, can people be instructed to see this point?
Mm.
Or do they all have to come to this point to cross it?
Mm.
Can they be supported to realize what is meant?
I suppose you have tried to explain this to the people in your group, but with little success.
Over years.
Yeah. So I think you've already answered your question. In some ways, bringing it up, you're very bringing it up. It might be where the person is at the right point and it connects.
Mm-hmm.
So please do continue to bring it up. But if the person is not there yet, is not ready, in one ear and out the other.
Talking to the wind.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. But I wouldn't stop mentioning it, because when the conditions are right, the person can be greatly helped by that. It's a big problem, not just in your group, but many groups I see. Some of the Soto groups in Europe, even some of the leaders of those groups have come and spoken with me and said basically the same thing. The guy who is now running our group is a zazen machine. It's perfect, but it's just this formal machinery.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no light, there's nothing else to it. And they don't know what to do. So Zen, the very word Zen is, in a sense, meditation. So sometimes people will call Zen the meditation school. But they have a very interesting attitude towards Zazen. Of course it's important. you know, in the Rohatsu, maybe 16 or 18 hours a day for a week sitting in zazen. Oh yeah, they take their zazen very seriously. But at the same time, there are all these stories, some of them true, some of them perhaps made up, about the limits, right? Even the dangers of becoming attached to the form of zazen from the very beginning. So I guess what I want to say is don't use this as an excuse to sit less. Rather, realizing it, then sit truly. Do you follow what I mean? This is not saying, okay, well then, it's really not so important anyway, so we can cut them down to 25-minute periods. Not at all, not at all. It's a very subtle point. When we come to the point that Hartmut's talking about, in a way, we sit even harder. It's a lot easier, but we sit but we sit harder. There is a danger, yeah, right? There's a danger if it's not explained properly, huh? Mm-hmm. Either one hand they become these zazen machines, or on the other hand they decide, oh yeah, that's right. Sitting doesn't get you enlightened anyway, so and then they just go on with their delusions.
It's as well a problem because people lose interest during that time. Mm-hmm. They're mm-hmm. starting to sit zazen and they have the problems, and mm-hmm. maybe they become routineered.
Yeah, it becomes routinized. Yeah. Routine.
Becomes routinized, and the people didn't see why to go further.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it only seems to be zazen. Mm. They are coming to do zazen for years, and they think nothing happens, and they lose interest.
Yeah.
They are going. Mm. And it's impossible to explain keep on, because you will have to reach a point and then zazen will turn to something else, to another dimension, or to another meaning.
Yeah.
And we have lost several people during that time before the point.
I wouldn't worry too much about it. I mean, I see that as the seed has been planted. And maybe at some point they will return. Maybe not. It's okay. Zazen is not the only way, and maybe it's not the way for them. But the seed has been planted. Do you know what I mean? It's there. And maybe somewhere along the line they will return to it, or they will see through what they couldn't see through before. So I wouldn't worry too much about it. Maybe the best thing you can do is just continue on in your sitting, and people have eyes, they can see, you know. They may not fully understand, but they can see, you know. It's not just it's not just the zazen machine. Anything else? Shall we open the rice crackers for the tea break now, or have them tomorrow?
Okay.
Yeah, okay. So.
You should actually open them. You want to?
Yeah. Well, go ahead. You open them up. You enjoy it so much. But I think we'll take the break first, because it takes about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, Japanese wrapping is about 7 layers in here. So, very simply, the rice cracker says, "Mountain stillness deepens." And again, the context was, the wind blows, after the wind stops blowing, a few petals fall. A bird sings, and then these three characters, mountain stillness deepens. Very simply connected with that other phrase about the wind blowing, right? it's not a matter of no sound, complete silence. We can experience the depth of the mountain, or here in the Netherlands, maybe we would say the polder deepens. That doesn't work, does it? Sounds awful muddy, doesn't it? Let's stick with the mountain. It's not, there's no sound, it's completely dead. No. When the dog barks, or the bird sings, or the ice falls in the freezer, when the time is right, these things happen. That simply expresses the depth of our stillness. Do you see? If it breaks your stillness, it wasn't true stillness, was it? If it brings you out of zazen, it wasn't true zazen. True stillness, true silence, cannot be broken. And the Chinese like to do it in nice nature metaphors with birds singing. So, once again, a bird sings, the mountain stillness. We'll start the break. You start unwrapping. Thank you for listening so intently.